Thanks so much for that reading, Mike, and I appreciate especially he was mindful. I was trying to figure out how best to get some of the elements of Paul's intro about love to the traditional part of the Advent reading in that scripture is talking about the darkness and light contrast. And Mike, I know, is very mindful of the context and help us get that with that extra verse as well. So thank you. And Lori and Vicky, I agree, very beautiful. You know, it's a really pretty refrain, the listen here, listen here. I don't think that many people would need a lot of encouragement to listen to you. We don't need a lot of things like that. So how many people here have heard of the thought experiment about Schrodinger's cat? Is that something that sounds kind of familiar? Yeah? So if you're not familiar, this is a thought experiment that is related to quantum physics and to philosophy. Basically, you're imagining that you put a cat in a box, you close up the box, you can't see the cat at all, and that can be in there for a while, and as functionally, Schrodinger says, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time because you can't know what the state of the cat actually is. And you can have these debates back and forth about why you think it's one or the other, but his point and his illustration, especially for its implications for quantum science, is that functionally, it is alive and dead at the same time. I bring this up because I think that we all have, in small little ways in our life, Schrodinger's somethings at any given time. So, for instance, right now, mine is the engine lights on my dashboard in my car. So I have a thing where when it rains, these lights will come on in my car, probably because there's issues with the connections. And they'll stay on for maybe like a week or two, and then they do eventually go away, but for that time they're on, and depending on how much it's raining, it can be basically like they're constantly on. I've taken it to a shop and like to AutoZone to check them here and there before, and they've basically every time said, nope, everything is fine. It is basically just indicating, the lights are indicating that the lights are not functioning correctly, and so that's okay. But functionally, like, I am counting on the fact that in all of that time, that if I assume that when I see the light come on, it doesn't mean anything, that it doesn't mean anything. If it so happens that when I'm used to the light malfunctioning, it turns out that one of those things is actually wrong, then I might be in trouble. But I am going on some faith of its own kind that I will be okay. Does anyone else have an example like that where you're just kind of like, it could go wrong at any time, but I'm kind of just hoping it goes along? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know they're out there somewhere, but they're dead to me.
There you go. Yeah. Mike, you have one too?
Yeah, my car has
check engine light on. Yep. I think stuff with cars are pretty popular that way. Right, so these are these small, practical, everyday types of hope that we often hold for ourselves. And usually these types of hope have this essence of, I hope that I won't be having to deal with the worst of this potential situation. And as we enter the Advent season, we don't jump ahead to Jesus being here, right? We sit, we wait, we experience all of the emotions that the people of God also had as they awaited for Emmanuel, the Messiah's arrival, ultimately Jesus, thousands of years ago. And the first theme that we highlight in Advent with that sense of waiting is this sense of hope. And in Advent, we could be drawn into that same dynamic like these Schrodinger somethings in our lives, where we just say, can we please get out of this, avoid the worst of something, God? Can you just get us to a good place in life or make sure that the worst doesn't show up? But in the classic Advent scriptures that we are given year over year, especially in the lectionary, and that we're going to be using these scriptures throughout the next month ourselves during Advent, we can see that what we root ourselves in to have this important posture of hope, we see a hope of a very particular character. And it's not that, please get me out of this, God, hope. But instead, it is a, please come in the middle of this, God. Please help us deal with whatever is going on by getting all of the way through it. And this is a hope that can be very transformative for our lives. It connects us more truly with who God is. And this is a God that does not want to avoid things, but a God that came fully amongst us and takes things on to God's self. This is not an automatic or an easy hope. Oftentimes, that type of hope can, in fact, be scary. We'd rather avoid certain things than go through them sometimes. Even if avoiding something ultimately is just kicking the can down the road, leaving it out there to eventually cause more problems for us rather than if we would have just gone ahead and dealt with it. So where does this hope that helps us go through things even when they're hard and painful, where does it come from? How can we tap into it for our own lives? Our verses today really do help us see that, even and especially in difficult situations. First, Psalm 122, shows us what it is like to hope by recognizing and accepting when we need to go through some of God's transformation. Because God is showing us that there are things that are getting in the way of our connection with God and in the way of our experience and others' experience of God's full salvation life for us. And if we can recognize and accept when God is calling us to that, even if that process that God may seem to be leading us to has things about it that are scary and challenging, we can live in that true hope. Now, this psalm is one in a long series of psalms in this section around the 120s of the book called Psalms of Ascent, like Brent mentioned for us. This basically meant that they were intended to be sung by people as they were ascending up the mountain that the temple was on. And so this would be people walking up there to worship, especially on high holy days, which also meant that these would often be people who were coming from all over the city, even all over the country, even all over the world, coming on the high holy days to worship, being like pilgrims. And we can relate maybe a little bit to that, traveling on special days, like we're in the midst of that as well. Now, most scholars believe that most of these psalms are from not that long after or around the time of the book of Esther that we were just doing our series on. If you look at Psalm 126, it will explicitly mention that this is a psalm about the time of being in exile. So if we remember, this time of exile is when the Jewish people had been conquered by other countries around from them and then carried into these other countries for 70 years before they could go back to Jerusalem and to Judea. And we read prophets throughout this time, like Isaiah and Jeremiah. They told them that the reason why they had been conquered and carried off is because this was an expression of God's judgment, that they had been operating too much as a people in injustice, in militarism, and in idolatry. And so God said, you have lost your way in hoping and connecting with me. You've put your faith in these other things. This can't continue. It's causing too much problems between you and with other people. We have to reset. But by this point, they had been able, because one of the nations that had conquered them, the Persians, had allowed them to go back and begin to rebuild the temple and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Many people had gone back and started to do this. The temple was available for worship again. But many people still stayed around the other countries and the other areas of empire because that's where they had built life. And they hadn't been able to go back to Jerusalem. Some of them stayed where they had been taken. So these songs were written to be sung by people with this whole range of experiences and emotions. It was going to help them bring their whole selves to God when they worshiped. They could be thankful and celebratory for some things like having the temple back and being able to celebrate their holidays together. But they would also still be wanting protection. They'd still be wanting relief and forgiveness. And they'd also still have some lingering mourning or anger or frustration and more. And all of this is being brought in these psalms. So when we understand this, we can see that the verses that the whole psalm hinges on, that are at the center of the song, are really, really powerful. The thing that the people are focusing their worship on, the thing that people are focusing their hope most on in this verse, is the judgment seat. And by the way, it's not the judgment seat that's going to come against all of their enemies and the people that they don't like that are outside the people of God. Not even those that have wronged them directly. But they have their hope and their worship in the judgment seat of God for themselves, for God's own people. And we can think about how remarkable that really is. people who have experienced God's judgment, even to great personal cost and loss to themselves, are planting hope and worship in that judgment in this song. Even though they've had something that was painful and difficult, they're not saying this and taking hope lightly. We can remember, though, that God did use the exile in many powerful ways for the Jewish people. For instance, the doctrine that God is not only contained within the temple, but God's presence can be anywhere with anyone at all times, was one that was realized because of the exile when the temple was gone, and they could see that God really was with them even when they were carried off. Also true is the promise of God bringing people from all nations of the earth together in peace and justice as one community. That was born out of the exile because the Jewish people were interacting with all of these other people that were also conquered, and that God was saying, I can bring all of them together. And ultimately, the prophets, like Isaiah and Jeremiah, also put a renewed focus on the true purpose of God's law, that it was not for some people to hold power over others, but ultimately for all people to serve each other, just as God does with the power that God has, serving the creation out of love and grace. So we can notice then how the rest of the psalm expresses what this worshiping and transformed exile people knew that they could hope in. That even from a process of God's judgment for what they had been doing that was tearing them apart, this judgment put them on a new path that could be shared and supportive as a process together, and that would ensure ultimately the common benefit and true life of all. And it really was all, by the way. The language of peace and prosperity that they want in their homeland that we see at the end of the song that concludes it, this mirrors language that the prophet Isaiah wrote in a letter to the exiles when they were first conquered and carried off. In this letter, as they were going to Babylon, Jeremiah said, God tells us to seek the peace and prosperity of the place that I am sending you, which meant people all over the world where they're going to be sent, even those who had started as the Jewish people's enemies. Because that is ultimately how shalom life, salvation life, true peace and prosperity would come for the Jewish people themselves, along with everyone else. And that letter, by the way, is also the one that contains a very famous phrase that many of us put our hope in. I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to give you a future and a hope. That's all tied up in this one song. And then similarly, the verses from Paul's letter to the Romans give us even more of a context for how God creates this hope for us, even from something as difficult as judgment, where God will invite us to let go of things that are keeping us from God and instead take up true salvation life for ourselves and all of God's people, even if it is difficult, challenging, and stretching for us. Paul's key image of what judgment can seem like is bringing things to light, moving from the darkness and night to the day and the light, which is sort of maybe like opening the box for Schrodinger's cat. Or it's like the engine lights on my dashboard. Or really, it's whatever else it is in our lives that we can very easily feel like, you know, it would just be better if this stayed in the dark. I want to save myself some pain. I want to save myself some embarrassment. I want to save myself from having to actually work through dealing with whatever this thing is and bringing it to resolution that I know it needs, but it's going to be really hard. It just feels overwhelming. Can I just like keep that off somewhere else? Paul surrounds these verses about reminding and encouraging us, bring it to the light, deal with it, even if it's hard and painful, with some very important context for what it means to come out of the darkness. God gives us a clear picture of what healthy, transformative judgment and change look like, rather than what often can be arbitrary, punitive, and therefore meaningless judgment that we can be used to other people trying to impose on us or that we've experienced at other times in our life. God's version is very different. And this context are essentially the godly values of love, patience, service, and grace. The first verses of this passage remind us that encouraging love that facilitates growth is the fulfillment of God's law and therefore also God's judgment. It's not about shaming exposure of people or brutal punishment, as some people often use judgment to be. It's about love rooting in it first. And then the last verses of the passage make it clear that healthy judgment is also not an effort to try to have some people take power for themselves and make everyone else be exactly like them. I figured out I'm the best type of person. I eat meat. I don't eat meat. Whatever it is, I'm going to make you be exactly like me. That's good judgment because I figured things out exactly the right way. Instead, we see that God has made room for us to have a range of expression on faith on many things. And so God's true judgment, in fact, guides us to have room for each other as well. This is really important because it means that we can have hope and trust that there's grace for who we are and what we need. We can also seek out God's discernment because then we will identify true healing and restoring purpose of even the most difficult things that God asks us to go through. And it's also really important that the grace and the discernment come before judgment. They're not a secondary, just simple makeup thing after the fact. Like, all right, I'm going to judge the thing, and then maybe after the person has felt a ton of threat and danger, then I'll say, oh, but I'll be gracious to you. Oh, but I'll have a little bit discernment and look at things a little bit more lovingly. Those start for God before the judgment comes. Our great hope when we come before God together is that the light of God's love can and will reveal the things in our life that need to change so that we can experience true salvation life. We want to see those things come out. We don't want them hidden. We don't want them lost. But that God will also, with that light, reveal a path for us to get where we need to be and that how we will support each other as we walk that path. This will definitely not involve pretending that things that need to be dealt with aren't there, nor will it be not taking them seriously. But instead, we will be able, in God's love and grace and service and patience and love, to be honest about them, going all the way through addressing them fully as they need to be. But God's light of love and grace and hope will also reveal where there's room for us and for others, where people might want to rush to early, unhealthy, harmful judgment. It'll show us where we can have that room for each other. And even more than that, it will reveal a true, positive, affirmative vision of what it looks like to be our full selves following God together. It's not just some cheap version of how you can avoid pain by just not being the wrong type of person. It's not identifying these are all the things you're not supposed to be and just get rid of that so that then you won't get hurt. It's God saying you can experience full life if you be these right things that I have created you to be and I can help you get there. And what that looks like is probably more beautiful and diverse than we might expect otherwise because God's the creator and we are the creation and we need the other creation around us to come with us too. A couple of years ago in these Advent sermons, I mentioned that we can sometimes treat the hope of salvation like God is faking our chart at the doctor's office, just writing clean bill of health on the front, whether any of our illnesses were actually dealt with or not. And that's not really what salvation is. It's really more like having the best possible health insurance that you can, where you don't have to worry about how expensive it is or whether the doctors will actually want to treat you or not, but that we know nothing is keeping me from bringing whatever it is that's harming me before the best possible physician, and I'm going to get it dealt with, I'm going to be healed, I'm going to be even new and more than what I was before because it's actually going to all get addressed. And so maybe this year we can add the image of hope and salvation not being like maybe me or Mike just putting electrical tape over the lights on our dashboard and saying, nope, it's all fine, nothing's there, no lights, everything's perfect. I am saved from the harm of my what could happen to my car. But instead, it's like having amazing car insurance and a very trustworthy mechanic who will actually restore everything to its best condition, maybe even better than it was new. Because we can also remember that the hope of what God does with our Schrodinger's cats or whatever else in our life, it's not about God poking the box every so often just to try to hear this very weak meow. It's not about shoving tiny food morsels through the cracks just in case. What God does, what the story of Jesus' arrival in our lives is that God gets right into the darkness and isolation of the box and busts it open like a tomb. Because it turns out that with God, it's not as important if we're just dead or not, but that in fact there's a way that we can be truly living, that God will take us through together no matter what it is that we will have to go through. That is what we will pursue together during Advent. That's what we do with our faith together. And that's what we will try to express for ourselves and others around us as we continue in worship with our offering.